The English language is like London, proudly barbaric yet deeply civilized too, common yet royal, vulgar yet processional, sacred yet profane. Each sentence we produce, whether we know it or not, is a mongrel mouthful of Chaucerian, Shakespearean, Miltonic, Johnsonian, Dickensian, and American. Military, naval, legal, corporate, criminal, jazz, rap, and ghetto discourses are mingled at every turn. So said Stephen Fry about the English language and its splendid diversity of words. I'm Emily Auerbach, and this is University of the Year. English is a rich but crazy language. Malapropisms, eponyms, portmanteaus, oxymorons, and palindromes are just some of the words about words we'll be exploring in a conversation about the joy of words. Joining me is a self-proclaimed lexophile or lover of words, Marshall Cook, emeritus professor in the Division of Continuing Studies, author of 30 books of fiction and nonfiction, editor of Extra Innings, an online newsletter for writers, their enablers, and lexophiles everywhere, radio host of Writers and Their Words out of the Sun Prairie Media Center, and vocabulary coach for the UW Odyssey Project. Welcome back to University of the Air.
Well, thank you, Emily. I love the introduction. That was mellifluous.
Well, let's start just on a personal level. You call yourself a lexophile. Tell me about you and words.
I think it was in the blood. I can't remember a time when I wasn't fascinated by words. My mother says I used to go out and sit on the front lawn and wait for the newspaper delivery kid to throw us the paper so I could just sit there and look at the paper and smell it and touch the pages. I mean, my grandfather was a writer, and I think, and I look a lot like him, and I think maybe I got it from him. And I always knew I wanted to be a writer.
Well, and you write both fiction and nonfiction.
Yep.
And read a lot and everything. So, you know, you're born into the language you're born into, and English is ours. Tell me about English and what that means for a lexophile as opposed to some other language that you might have had as your first language.
Well, it's the richest language on earth, and by a lot. German is second in terms of number of words, and English has four times the number of words that German does.
So when you say the richest, you mean in terms of just sheer volume?
Volume, choices. You know, if you can't find just the right word that not only means the right thing but sounds right and fits the rhythm of what you're writing, work harder because you can do it. It's available. And it grows by something like 15 words a day or something. It's just.
So is that richness because we've stolen words from
mostly,
all over the place?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very derivative language. And, of course, as a lot of you who have trouble with spelling will attest, we don't change the spellings usually when we take them from French or someplace. So we have some pretty funny words to spell.
As you know, because we both teach in the Odyssey Project where we have students who are from Mexico, Gambia, Trinidad, just all kinds of different places.
Syria,
Iraq. Sometimes I feel apologetic about English because it is surprisingly illogical and difficult to learn in terms of spelling and all those other things.
The spelling's nuts.
Yeah.
And there have been movements to try to simplify and make it phonetic spelling and all of that. But it's like trying to convert us to the metric system. It's not going to happen.
Well, in terms of the language, can you share? I know the one thing that you sometimes bring into the Odyssey class is by Richard Lederer. And first of all, say something about him and language. And then the one that's the case for short words might be a good place to start.
I love it. I got to meet Richard Lederer once. And when I introduced myself, he said, "Marshall." You know, and he gave me the whole derivation, the whole etymology of the word. And he said, "You know, I think that's the only name where you can make, oh, how many did he say, 8 or 11 words out of the words in your name without changing the order of any of them." And he proceeded to do so. And I watched him.
Oh, so like Mars, Marsh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Marsha.
Yeah.
Marshall with one L. And then you can go back all, hall, shell. And I hadn't realized that. And I watched him give a couple of talks, and he doesn't use notes. And people ask him questions about words, and he knows. And I don't. I have piles of notes in front of me here, but I love the language like he does. And here's something that we always have for the Odyssey students, either the first day or the second day of class. And it's called the case for short words. And it's by Richard Lederer, and it comes from, do I have it here?
Yeah.
Yes, a book called The Miracles of Language, which is just a wonderful book full of short essays about the English language. And I'm going to give you the first five paragraphs, first four paragraphs, and then I'm going to pop the secret question. When you speak and write, there is no law that says you have to use big words. Short words are as good as long ones, and short old words like sun and grass and home are best of all. A lot of small words, more than you might think, can meet your needs with a strength, grace, and charm that large words do not have. Big words can make the way dark for those who read what you write and hear what you say. Small words cast their clear light on big things. Night and day, love and hate, war and peace, and life and death. Big words at times seem strange to the eye and the ear and the mind and the heart. Small words are the ones we seem to have known from the time we were born, like the hearth fire that warms the home. Short words are bright like sparks that glow in the night, prompt like the dawn that greets the day, sharp like the blade of a knife, hot like salt tears that scald the cheek, quick like moths that flit from flame to flame, and terse like the dart and sting of a bee. Here's a sound rule. Use small, old words where you can. If a long word says just what you want to say, do not fear to use it. But know that our tongue is rich in crisp, brisk, swift, short words. Make them the spine and the heart of what you speak and write. Short words are like fast friends. They will not let you down.
I just love that.
I do, too. And it's beautiful writing, and it flows, and it makes images in your mind. Mm-hmm. And then I ask the students, what do you notice about the language here? And they say, well, it's all short words. And mm-hmm. Yes, it is. How short are they? And generally by now, somebody picks it. It would be Nathaniel this year, mm-hmm. I think, would pick up on it. Somebody says, they're all one-syllable words.
And I assume that a lot of these words are the sort of Anglo-Saxon kind of words, more like dirt and, you know, the earthy words rather than the fancy Latin ones that came into the language.
I used to teach people always use short Anglo-Saxon words, and then I realized one day I didn't know if a word was Anglo-Saxon or not. So I just stuck with short and some of the old ones. By the way, I don't know why that reminds me, but the New York Times crossword puzzle on Sunday had a mistake. They had the plural of octopus being octopi.
And it's not?
It is not. It is octopuses. It's from Greek, so you mm-hmm. don't do to the plural what you do with a Latin derivative word.
Until enough people make a mistake and then they decide to count it.
Because
I think one of the things that's exciting about looking at words is that they do change over time. You get new ones in, like Google it, and, you know,
the
language is a flexible thing. I'm always astonished to learn, and I've forgotten the figure, but just how many words came into the language because of Shakespeare?
1,700.
That's amazing.
He is credited with inventing 1,700 words. Not to say phrases that we think are cliches now, but
like it's Greek to me, and it's just I find that astonishing that you know so many words would come in from one writer.
He's a pretty astonishing writer.
Yeah.
He or they or who.
Yeah.
I happen to think it was Shakespeare, but I don't know.
Well, to play devil's advocate then, because you just read this
yes.
case for short words, one-syllable words, but then wouldn't that suggest that all these magnificent, giant, you know, polysyllabic words shouldn't be used? I mean, he does say, if a long word says just what you want to say, do not fear to use it. But the implication of that piece is why? You know, why use a fancy highfalutin word if a short one will do?
Yeah.
So why does English need all the, you know, thousands of words it
reminds
has?
Me of the joke, why is monosyllabic so many syllables?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And I get into that with my students because they say we're going to learn some long, long words. And I want them to know how to attack any word. So, you know, I don't want them to be intimidated by the size or the fact that it comes from Latin or any of that. I want to help get them the tools so that they're not afraid to attack any word. And you assign to them some really tough stuff.
Well, sure, like Plato and Shakespeare.
Yeah, and we don't read textbooks in there, folks. We read the original sources. So that's one reason why it's good to attack. But some of them are wonderful words and beautiful words. And depending on the audience that you write for, you know, you write to the level you think your audience is on and stretch them a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think that's okay, too. But I want them to be comfortable with all of the language and to embrace it and to know that it's theirs.
So what's the longest word or words that you know of?
Do you want the longest official word or
sure.
the ones that's actually used? The longest word in standard English, but not used a whole lot, is 45 letters long. And one of our students who had seen this word on one of my handouts asked me how to pronounce it because she got diagnosed with it.
Oh, boy.
It has to do with having holes in the lung. Yeah, and it is, and I'll give it my best try here, but I teach students to take them in little pieces. Pneumo, nolultra, microscopic, silicovolcano, oconosis. And it's some kind of disease.
Yes, it doesn't sound like you'd want to have it, I have to say that.
No.
I always was taught that the longest word was anti-disestablishmentarianism.
Yeah, and a lot of people accept that as a standard word in the English language. It's actually a little shorter, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that one you can figure out what it means easily from etymon's word parts, yeah.
What about long words that we do use?
The two longest words they say, and I got this off the internet, so it must be right, are 22 letters each. And then neither one of them is that tough a word. Counter-revolutionaries. And, of course, you always add an S if you're mm-hmm. going for the longest word. And deinstitutionalization.
I would think you can make up all kinds of sort of giant polysyllabic words just by kind of mashing them together
yeah.
in different ways.
And, of course, we do make portmanteau words and
okay,
all sorts
let's
of
take
combined
that one.
Words.
Give me a definition of portmanteau.
I love that. Portmanteau is actually a kind of suitcase that's fairly common in Britain, and it's like two suitcases on a hinge. And so you pack one side of your suitcase, and then you pack the other side of your suitcase, and then you can snap it together. And then it weighs, you know, 50 pounds, and you have to check it, and they charge you a lot of money. But that's a portmanteau. So a portmanteau word is when you take two words and mash them together and usually leave something out in the middle. So common word that we use all the time is brunch.
Sure.
And that's breakfast and lunch.
Lunch,
yeah. The word smog actually came from smoke and fog, which is interesting because that's not what makes smog, but it's perfectly understandable. And we do things like bradulina.
Or bromance.
Bromance, yeah. Mm-hmm. I like that one. I think that's a good one. And, you know, old mossbacks like me, I get very upset with some of the new words. You know, that's not a word. But that is, as you said, one of the marvelous things about English. It's a growing, living language, and it changes all the time. I have on here, too, retronyms, which are words that we have to make up for things like telephone because there's a newer technology that has superseded it. So we say things like a dial phone, if we mean mm-hmm. an old rotary phone, which most of the people we work with now have never even seen, mm-hmm. let
Except
alone a...
Maybe in old movies or something.
Yeah, yeah, a phone booth, you know. Mm-hmm. What is that? We say acoustic guitar to separate it from the electric guitar. Analog watch. Well, that used to be a watch is what that was. So, you know, that's another way the language grows. And, of course, we get words from science all the time.
It seems English that, you know, that we have a different approach than, say, the French do, where there's an academy and that,
yes.
you know, they're trying to protect the purity of the language and keep out sort of words like, you know, le weekend or something.
Oh,
that,
no.
But I guess with English... it does become sort of a question as to what counts and what doesn't, who makes the decision that a word is okay now when it used to not be. And
yeah, and students ask that a lot. Who decides? Who decided that was wrong? Who decided that was the right way to spell it? And that was Noah Webster. His dictionary was the first time when he tried to codify standard spellings for English words. And, you know, in the great scheme of things, that's not that long ago. In Shakespeare's time, for instance, you spelled it any way you wanted to. And he'll spell words differently, you know, six or seven times in one act.
Yeah, Jane Austen, too. She spells friend with the E-I instead of the I-E, and all kinds of different spellings come up, and it doesn't seem to have bothered people as much. And then, of course, you have the difference between British English,
yes,
American English, and all kinds of other Englishes now.
Yes. And Webster's the guy who knocked the U out of words like humor. He said there's no reason why we should spell it the British
ones.
Way. It's not humour. But the arbiters now are really us by usage. And if we use something wrong long enough, it will become accepted. The OED will be the last place probably to accept it. And some of the stuffier dictionaries will say slang, colloquial, not recommended, but they'll let it in.
Mm-hmm.
And so by usage does it. But if you want to be correct, you still go to a source like the dictionary.
Although the dictionary can be tricky, too. We had a student in the third year of the Odyssey class from another country, from Palestine, and I remember one of the questions that she was asked at the beginning was to look up the word Odyssey and learn where it came from.
Yes.
And write about how it might apply to our program, our Jumpstart College Humanities program. She looked up Odyssey, and it said by Homer. So she looked up Homer, and it was talking about the home run in a baseball game. And so then she said the class would be like hitting a home run in a game. And
that's,
the dictionary,
that's pretty good. That's
right,
pretty inventive.
But the dictionary can, you know, I think that's one of the things that I know you love about words is the humor that can come when either someone from another country or a child who's just learning the language or someone who sort of doesn't mean to, but they make a mistake, which is both funny and then also sort of wise unintentionally, or
yeah,
has its own kind of play on words. And we're going to look at some of those, the malapropisms, the spoonerisms, all kinds of things that people do with language when they don't mean to, and it creates a lot of humor. More on that when we continue in a moment with University of the Air.
This is Sweater Weather, A Love Song to Language, and it's by Sharon Bryan from a collection called Flying Blind. Never better, mad as a hatter, right as rain, might and main, hanky-panky, hot toddy, hoity-toity, cold shoulder, bowled over, rolling in clover, low blow, no soap, hope against hope, pay the piper, liar, liar, pants on fire, high and dry, shoe fly pie. Fiddle faddle, fit as a fiddle, sultan of swat, muskrat ramble, fat and sassy, flim flam, happy as a clam. Cat's pajamas, bee's knees, peas in a pod, pleased as punch, pretty as a picture, nothing much. Lift the latch, double dutch, helter skelter, hurdy gurdy, early bird, feathered friend, dumb cluck, buck up, shilly-shally, willy-nilly, roly-poly, holy-moly, loose lips, sink ships, spitting image, nip in the air, hale and hearty, part and parcel, upsy-daisy, lazy days, maybe baby, up to snuff, flibbity-gibbet, honky-tonk, spick and span, handyman, cool as a cucumber, blue moon, high as a kite, night and noon, love me or leave me, seventh heaven, up and about, over and out.
That's the poem Sweater Weather, a Love Song to Language, read by my guest, Marshall Cook. I'm Emily Auerbach, and we are talking about the joy of words, and the, in particular, the richness of the English language. We're going to talk now about some, and I don't know, I have to say, just listening to that, it almost doesn't matter what the meaning is. It just sounds good, and you get the feeling of a poet in that case who just loves playing with language and phrases and sayings. And
one of my favorite songwriters is Roger Miller, and a lot of his stuff doesn't make any sense at all. It's just sound, and it's wonderful.
Yeah. You know,
he knew how to do that.
One of the things that I like about language is the humor that can happen, especially in a language that is as complicated and is illogical and diverse as English is, where one person's attempt to use the language incorrectly can lead to funny outcomes. Can you tell us about some of those kinds of words about words, maybe starting with one that I had actually never heard of until recently, and that's mondegreen.
I had never heard of it until a couple of years ago, too. I do want to give a shout-out, though, to Professor Irvin Corey, the foremost expert on everything in the world. He died recently at 103, and his act was all giving ridiculous answers and mangling the English language, supposedly talking sense, and he did it beautifully. Of course, he was doing it on purpose. Mondegreen, and we've all done this, especially with the advent of car radios. You know, you listen to a song, and if you're listening to it in the car, and if it's some of the songs that are out now, it's hard to hear the words, but the tune gets caught in your ear. And you've got the tune going through, and you know a little bit of the words, and you kind of make them up or think maybe this was right. By the way, Paul McCartney, when he wrote lyrics, he would get the tune first, usually. And if he didn't have the lyric yet, he would put in placeholders as long as they scanned the same way. And for a long time, yesterday was scrambled eggs. Scrambled eggs.
It's kind of a different song that way.
Yes.
And why is it called mondegreen?
I will tell you. There's a story, and this is, it might be apocryphal, but it's awfully good, so I'll tell it. It's called a mondegreen because an author named Sylvia Wright heard the lyrics of the Bonnie Earl of Murray. And she heard, or thought she heard, "Ye highlands and ye lowlands, oh, where a' you been, thou a' slay the Earl of Murray and Lady Mondegreen." Okay? So we're rhyming green with bean, I guess. In fact, the last words are, "and lay them on the green."
So lay them on the green instead
Lady Mondegreen. Yeah, yeah. So that's supposedly why she got her title, or is that her title or her name? Anyway, she got that stuck on her.
So a mondegreen would be a mishearing of lyrics of a song.
Yeah, yeah. And you gave two examples in class.
Oh, from my children, yes. My son, David, when he was listening to A Christmas Carol, the Away in a Manger one, thought that it was Littler Cheeses asleep in the hay instead of Little Lord Jesus.
Yes. Yeah.
And then daughter Melanie thought that the Give Me a Home Where the Buffalo Roam was also Where the Deer and the Cantaloupe Play.
Yes.
So, yeah, hearing cantaloupe for antelope or spoonful of Madison instead of medicine makes a spoonful of sugar helps the Madison go down was what my other daughter. So, yes.
I don't think it helps, but it might.
Anyway, what are some of the other mondegreens?
Oh, I
not
love
from
these.
My family.
There's the song recorded by Crystal Gayle, most famously, "Don't It Make My Brown Eyes Blue?" And that came out, "Donuts Make My Brown Eyes Blue." If you eat too many donuts, folks. And the wonderful song, Astru Gilberto, composed and performed this song. "The Girl from Ipanema Goes Walking" came out, "The Girl from Emphysema Goes Walking."
That'd be a different kind of walk.
I love that. And Bob Dylan's anthem, "Blowing in the Wind," somebody thought he was saying, "The ants are my friend," not "the ants are my friends." And something from the Beatles, which was probably trippy enough that any words would have gone. But there's a line in Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, whom people at the time interpreted as being a song about LSD. The girl with kaleidoscope eyes, which if you've ever seen a kaleidoscope is just a fantastic image. But that came out, the girl with colitis goes by. So whoever did that had a good vocabulary to throw colitis in there.
And sometimes it seems that there can be a kind of truth that happens when you take a word and you change it a little bit. I don't know if this counts as – I guess this wouldn't count as a mondegreen, but a student in class – because it's not from a song. The saying, don't judge a book by its cover, a student who was trying to talk about racism and stereotypes said, don't judge a book by its color, which is just simply tweaking a saying too. So well, other examples where you have the wrong word used, you've got the character in the Sheridan play, Mrs. Malaprop. Tell us about her.
Yes, she led to the coinage of the word, and this is an eponym, by the way, and I understand we'll talk about those in a little bit. You can either call them malaprops or malapropisms. I prefer malaprops just because it's shorter. And they're also called dogberryisms. And that's a whole nother story, but we'll stick with Mrs. Malaprop. William Sheridan wrote a play called The Rivals. It was first performed in 1775. And he wrote a character in there who just mangled the English language, and usually because she was reaching for a highfalutin word, you know, a word that would make her sound very smart. And that's the real humor of it, of course, is when somebody is overreaching and they do it. Archie Bunker was a great example of that. But she said at one point, if I reprehend anything in this world, it is the use of my oracular tongue and a nice derangement of epitaphs. This nonsense utterance might be corrected to, if I apprehend anything in this world, it is the use of my vernacular tongue and a nice arrangement of epithets.
That's quite a
Which
difference.
Is a mouthful in itself, but you can see why she stumbled over it. Dogberry, by the way, was a character in a Shakespeare play, Much Ado About Nothing. And he would say words that were close, but not right.
You mentioned Archie Bunker. What's an example from? I remember seeing him kind of and there it was kind of playing on someone who was uneducated and trying to get the words and it would come out wrong.
Our lovable bigot that Norman Lear invented. And Popeye the Sailor used to do that a lot too. And he mispronounced words. How rebarrasking.
Yeah. Or Archie Bunker, the women's lubrication movement.
Oh, yes. There's a good one. And I like Stan Laurel used to do that a lot. I love Laurel and Hardy. If you're ever visiting me in the hospital and I'm very sick, bring a Laurel and Hardy CD and I'll be fine. That will make me laugh no matter what. And the late great mayor of Chicago, the first Richard Daley, was quite known for this. And he once referred to Alcoholics Unanimous, which must be quite a group.
Yeah. And there was a dean, no, who was Spooner? A pastor.
Yeah.
Tell me about Pastor Spooner, because that's another group of
And another
words.
Eponym from which we get the word Spoonerism. That's when you flip-flop either the beginnings or a stressed syllable in two words. And it comes out something like this. And these are all attributed to Pastor William Archibald Spooner, the lucky guy. And apparently he really said them. The Lord is a shoving leopard. And he meant loving shepherd. You can see the inversion. And this, I think this is my favorite. Three cheers for our queer old dean, meaning dear old queen. And, of course, we in academia particularly
like
love that
Like the queer
one.
Old dean.
Someone is occupying my pie, please sew me to another sheet, which is someone is occupying my pew, please show me to another seat. And you have hissed all my mystery lectures. You have missed all my history lectures. And he apparently did that all the time and not on purpose.
That almost seems like a kind of dyslexia on a word level rather than just flipping letters.
If we'd been able to diagnose then, we probably would have cured the poor guy.
But it's kind of delightful, too, to have the Lord as a shoving leopard.
Yeah.
And then just to kind of think about that and as opposed to loving shepherd.
I maintain that some of my best stuff has come from typos.
Autocorrect these days.
Yes.
Where things can come out just incredibly funny. If you meant to write beat and it came out beer, just different little switches in letters or words can make an entirely different meaning.
It's almost like playing that game Mad Lib, mm-hmm. where you put words into a thing and see how it comes out.
Now, you've mentioned the term eponym a few times.
Yeah.
So let's turn to that and what an eponym is.
And we get to this pretty early in Odyssey because mm-hmm. we hit one of the authors for sure by Christmas time. An eponym is a word that starts as a person's name, and it can be a real person or a fictional person, and actually enters into the language as a lowercase word, meaning that person's dominant characteristic or what we most know that person for. And the example that everyone always gets is Scrooge, from Ebenezer Scrooge. And that is a miser, a skinflint, a meanie, just not a nice man. And that, of course, is from the character Ebenezer Scrooge, the protagonist of, I think, one of the most famous stories of all time and one of the favorites of a lot of people, A Christmas Carol. And the word Scrooge, and I had to go back and look this up, of course, and I'm sure Dickens was aware of this because he had words like he named a mean schoolmaster Mr. Choke-em-Child.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, he has Mr. McChoke-em-Child, and he has other ones, Grad Grind, for kind of grinding. So definitely he was playing with the sound of words for characters.
And I'll bet he knew this. Scrooge comes from an obscure English verb to scrouge or to scrudge, which means to squeeze or to press. And you just think of Scrooge squeezing money or squeezing poor Bob Cratchit. So I'm sure he had that in mind. And here's his first description of Scrooge, and this tells you everything you need to know about Ebenezer Scrooge. And I think it's beautiful, so I like to read it. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his thin lips blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. Shrewdly mm-hmm. in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head and on his eyebrows and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about him. He iced his office in dog days and didn't thaw it 1 degree at Christmas.
That's such a terrific
use of words.
Isn't that
wonderful?
And even in that list of verbs like the squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutches, it's just hard to say that without kind of almost growling. Like
your face gets all tightened up.
So a Scrooge, if it's used with a lowercase and, you know, don't be a Scrooge.
Yeah.
I've seen that in ads where it says, be a Santa, don't be a Scrooge,
yeah.
give a cell phone this Christmas or whatever it is. So
And Santa and Scrooge are, you know so, mm-hmm. some of these language things have private connotations or mm-hmm. meanings. And an author, of course, never knows how a reader will react to that. But Scrooge and Santa, you can pretty well count on the person who's hearing the commercial getting that.
Right. And I suppose another literary character then that would turn into an eponym would be from Don Quixote.
Don Quixote de la Mancha. Yes, from what many people say was the first novel, and many people still say, if not the greatest, one of the greatest. It's a hard read, I mm-hmm. think, but a wonderful novel. Miguel de Cervantes wrote it. Don Quixote's original name was Alonso Quijano Quijano, Alonso Quijano. And then he went a little crazy and decided that he was a knight errant back in the days of chivalry. And he donned his armor and was it a real lance or a fake lance?
I don't remember, but he tilted at windmills.
He tilted at windmills, which is where we get that expression. He saw them as dragons. And that's somebody who tilts at windmills is fighting lost causes or doesn't understand what he's fighting. So the name Quixotic, we pronounce it differently now, but Quixotic means someone who's very, very idealistic, because Don Quixote was, and you love him for it, but somewhat unrealistic and impractical, and maybe even a little nuts.
Yeah, and I think we also, for another eponym, Sandwich, from the Earl of Sandwich.
Yes.
I don't know if it's apocryphal or real, but something about how he wanted to eat without interrupting his billiards game.
Yes,
so he just had somebody bring him bread and meat so he could keep playing, and then the Earl of Sandwich turned into Sandwich.
And with most of these words like that, there are all kinds of stories, and you have to sort of, which one sounds most logical, or which one did I see in the most good sources?
I think I've seen three different versions of where we got the word lynch, in terms of from a person named that and other things and disagreements about
that. Plantation owner was one of them.
Yeah, so
and of course, the story of where we got the hamburger, which is not ham, of course. That's part of the fun of the English language. A lot of people in Seymour, Wisconsin claim it was Charlie Negron at the State Fair in 1896. And he was selling meatballs, and people didn't have anything to hold them with. So he got a loaf of bread and started squashing the meatballs and putting them between two slices of bread. And that supposedly was the birth of the hamburger.
But it's not named after
him. It's not an Negron, I know.
Not an eponym then. Another kind of nym would be a metonym. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's the word where we substitute the name of an attribute for the thing itself. For instance, we call business executives or maybe Wall Street brokers suits.
Sure.
People who wear suits. And it's usually used derogatorily. Mm-hmm. It's not a compliment. You don't go to the horse races. You go to the track, right? We don't say the New York Stock Exchange. We say Wall Street to mean all of the stock exchanges. And the ad industry, of course, is Madison Avenue. And in England, newspaper publishers, that's Fleet Street, because that's where most of the big publishers are. And all the time we use the White House.
Sure.
The White House today announced. Well, it may not have anything
then
to do with the president even, but it certainly isn't the building.
Well, and back to Dickens, he used, especially in his novel Hard Times, he used the phrase the hands to refer to the workers. You know, like the hands have done such and such for the hired hands, looking at assembly line workers and how they had become dehumanized into just the hands.
Yeah, yeah. And one that laps over into the euphemism category, we don't talk about soldiers anymore, or foot soldiers, as they used to be known, or ground troops.
Oh, you're talking about boots on the ground.
And I loathe that expression because it gets past the fact that those are people.
Well, let's go to euphemisms next.
Let's go to euphemisms.
Euphemisms, because language is not just something that's a matter of play and fun and poetry and all the rest of it. It also has a political side to it.
Oh, absolutely.
If you misuse language deliberately, it can make a huge difference in how people perceive things. So first of all, give us a definition of euphemism.
Sure. It's the substitution of a mild word for a one that has sharp edges or even is considered obscene in the culture, or an indirect word or a vague word. And that's where we start getting into trouble, because language is so often used to persuade. It's used to convey experience. Certainly it's used to move us emotionally. But a lot of times it's aimed at persuading, and not all that persuasion is rational. A lot of it is good speakers, good writers can use language that way. So it's to get rid of offensiveness, supposedly, but also maybe to deceive.
And to hide the raw truth or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, the word euphemism comes from euphonous, Greek, for sweet-voiced. So someone with a golden tongue, sweet-tongued.
So if we have a garbage man who's described as a sanitation engineer, it distances us from that raw garbage.
Yeah. And we don't have to think so much about the fact that we actually are relying on people who have to muck around in our mm-hmm. garbage all the time. And it's distasteful, and we wouldn't want to do that. But thank heavens we've got people who do it for us.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So there's a little bit of dishonesty.
It's not surprising there'd be euphemisms about bodily functions and,
yeah.
and all that, you know, covering
we
up.
We have more words for two of the more prime bodily functions than for almost anything else in the English language. And I've always thought that says something about the culture.
You know? Well, I remember reading that in the time of Queen Victoria, they were so reticent to use direct language that her pregnancy was referred to as being in an interesting condition. And I think she had 10 children or something like that. So
she was a very interesting
very
woman.
Very interesting. Well, and you know, interesting was a word that my mother taught me to use if we were out to dinner and you were served a casserole that you didn't like and were asked, how do you like it? You would say, this is a really interesting casserole. So euphemisms sometimes are sort of a safe way to avoid being honest.
Except when they're overused. And any author will tell you that, well, you know,
yeah.
if you ask somebody how they liked your book, which may or may not be a good thing to do, and you get back interesting.
Not a good
thing.
No,
you didn't even read it, did you?
And there's things for children, too. So you, instead of just saying that your child is out of, you know, is not well-behaved, it's spirited or creative or something like that.
And some people apparently still think autism is a bad word. So we use on the spectrum. Which means on the autism spectrum,
right.
which we probably all are.
Well, George Orwell in his Politics and the English Language looks more in, at the sinister side where
yeah.
the military actions that we do can be – and certainly during the Vietnam War too where certain phrases can be used euphemistically to hide what's actually happening in terms of deaths.
Yeah. And when I introduce this to students in Odyssey, I say euphemism is – sometimes a matter of personal beliefs. I mean, it bothers me that we have body counts and that we defoliate where what we're doing is bombing, and we terminate with extreme rapidity or something like
mm-hmm.
that, meaning kill,
mm-hmm.
And we send in peacekeepers, and you know if we're going to vote for people who send our men and women into war, we ought to face what it is we're sending them into. And euphemisms can shield us from that. I've got a funny example that I want to give. And I think this is just something somebody made up. But the example is a man committed murder, was found guilty, and was sentenced to die in the electric chair in Sing Sing. After he died, his father gave the eulogy at his funeral, and noted that he once occupied the chair of applied electricity in one of New York's leading institutions.
Oh. Well, but I can see both that euphemisms, you know, you can see why they're used, but also that it really does kind of keep us from facing the raw truth, in that case, of the horror of the death penalty. So,
it's much nicer to call a prison a correctional institution.
Right.
And some of them do some correcting. San Quentin's a good example. They actually have wonderful programs. But a lot of them don't do any correcting. They do a lot of punishing.
That's right. We're going to look at a few final thoughts on the craziness of the English language
when
we continue in a moment with University of the Air. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marshall Cook, and we are talking about the joy of words and both the richness and the craziness of the English language. English language has over a million words, with new ones created every day, and four times more words, you said, than the second language, German.
Second place, yeah.
It's filled with lots of words that are hard to spell, hard to learn, hard to remember, but joyous to kind of approach the variety that's there. You opened with a piece by Richard Lederer on the power of short words, one-syllable words that really can pack a punch and say so much. He's also got a piece on English as a crazy language. Can you share some of that?
I would love to. Let's face it, English is a crazy language. There is no egg in eggplant, nor ham in hamburger, neither apple nor pine in pineapple. English muffins weren't invented in England, nor French fries in France. So all that stuff about freedom fries was in vain. Sweetmeats are candies, while sweetbreads, which aren't sweet, are meat. We take English for granted, but if we explore its paradoxes, we find that quicksand can work slowly, boxing rings are square, and a guinea pig is neither from Guinea nor is it a pig. And why is it that writers write but fingers don't fing? Grocers grosh and hammers don't ham. If the plural of tooth is teeth, why isn't the plural of booth beef? One goose, two geese. One moose, two meese. One index, two indices? Doesn't it seem crazy that you can make amends but not one amend? That you comb through annals of history but not a single annal? If you have a bunch of odds and ends and get rid of all but one of them, what do you call it? If teachers taught, why don't preachers prot? If a vegetarian eats vegetables, what does a humanitarian eat? You can do that one with adultery and childhood, too. If you wrote a letter, perhaps you boat your tongue? Sometimes I think all the English speakers should be committed to an asylum for the verbally insane. In what language do people recite at a play and play at a recital? Ship by truck and send cargo by ship. Have noses that run and feet that smell. Park on driveways and drive on parkways. That's a union cab ad we hear all the time around here. How can a slim chance and a fat chance be the same, while a wise man and a wise guy are opposites? How can overlook and oversee be opposites? Well, quite a lot and quite a few are alike. Quite a few bothers me a lot, by the way. How can the weather be hot as hell one day and cold as hell another? Have you noticed that we talk about certain things only when they're absent? Have you ever seen a horse-full carriage or a strap-full gown? Met a sung hero or experienced requited love? Have you ever run into someone who was combobulated, gruntled, ruly, or peckable? And where are all those people who are spring chickens or who would actually hurt a fly? You have to marvel at the unique lunacy of a language in which your house can burn up as it burns down, in which you fill in a form by filling it out, and in which an alarm clock goes off by going on. English was invented by people, not computers, and it reflects the creativity of the human race, which, of course, isn't a race at all. That is why, when the stars are out, they are visible. But when the lights are out, they are invisible. And why, when I wind up my watch, I start it, but when I wind up this essay, I end it.
great.
And we'll just add that's an analog watch that he's winding.
Yes, we don't
do that anymore either.
But doesn't that sort of, I guess what I was getting at before is I feel apologetic to people learning English about all this kind of stuff. Because, and sometimes if you're editing a paper and you're trying to explain why the preposition in instead of on or up or down or some of these things, it's so hard to explain them because they're not consistent.
I've taught ESL, and of course people ask, well, why is it that way? And then over here it's this way. And I can only say, ours not the question why, ours but to do or die.
I know, you know, my father came as an immigrant from Germany, but one of the books that he really enjoyed was by Leo Rostin called The Education of Hyman Kaplan about this sort of night school for immigrants who are struggling with idiom and funny uses of the English language. And one of the phrases I remember from that book was, you know, if your eye falls on a bargain, pick it up.
Yes.
The eye that fell on the bargain. So, but just that struggling to figure out odd uses of phrasing. And
didn't we have somebody in Odyssey a couple of years back who was just mystified by off the wall?
Yeah.
How can it be off the wall?
Well, and I've had some people respond if I say, well, I can't do it, I'm all tied up, who act like, well, am I tied? Am I roped up? And we use so many metaphorical expressions, too, like I'm swamped.
The sun rises. No, it doesn't.
Yeah, so just so many different things with English. I like the way, too, you can put together combinations of words in unexpected ways, as with oxymorons. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I love oxymorons. That's when two words are juxtaposed, put together, that don't seem to belong together at all, like bittersweet. And that one makes perfect sense. You know, we've all felt that. We know that. I would say that civil war is an oxymoron. Mm-hmm. Freezer burn. I love that one. And it does feel like a burn. Friendly fire. Mm. Nah, if you shot somebody, it wasn't very friendly. I like ill health. Well, that makes perfect sense. You're in bad health, but it's the word ill with the word health. Living dead, which we have all sorts of now with the zombie craze. A militant pacifist. Mm. I think I might have been one of those.
Or a devout agnostic.
Devout agnostic. Or my brother was an evangelical atheist. That's what I used to call him. He called me worse. Original copy. Well, that's either. Mm-hmm. Wise fool. Now, that kind of makes some sense, getting back to what you said about errors sometimes having a lot of wisdom.
Well, certainly Shakespeare brought in a lot of wise fools.
Yes. Yes. Polonius. Mm-hmm. God bless him. This one is so true now, working vacation. You know, we bring our cell phones along. I love this one, unbiased opinion. Well, wait a minute. Do you want my opinion or not?
Jumbo shrimp.
Jumbo shrimp. I there's a sign I use with our students sometimes. People do this quite unaware of what they're saying, apparently, but there was a sign posted that said, parking for drive-through service only. That's a whole oxymoronic phrase.
Well, and certainly the phrase deafening silence.
Yeah.
Let's just say you've given a speech and you look at the audience and there's no response, silence can be deafening.
Yeah. Or you're on the radio and all of a sudden you clutch or there's no one calling or.
Yeah.
Yeah, that can be a deafening silence, and 10 seconds is a long one.
Yeah, so I guess the words help us try to explain some of the contradictory things that we're feeling.
Yeah.
And sometimes they can deliver a bite, as with if you take military intelligence as an oxymoron,
yes.
For example, people will say something like, you know, to imply that one thing can't go with another. I've seen things, too, back in the abolitionist time where American slavery or Christian slavery.
Christian slavery.
That is held up, or holy war, where it's held up as an example of an oxymoron, a paradox, a thing that cannot be so.
Yeah, but the thing is, if they're used enough, we come to accept the truth of it. You know, this is Christian slavery. This is okay. Because we have a phrase for that. And that's the danger, that we stop seeing the literal meaning of the two words.
Well, and speaking of phrase, when my son was three and he was acting up and I was trying to scold him, he said, "It's okay, I'm just going through a phrase." And I guess that's a good place to end this. We could go on with all kinds of wonderful things. I know people who might want to sign up for your creative free online journal called Extra Innings. They can contact you through Continuing Studies. You have a radio show out of Sun Prairie every other Tuesday. If you want to learn more about Odyssey Project, you can Google that at Madison. Lots of ways to get involved with the joy of words. Marshall
Absolutely.
Cook, thank you for being a wonderful guest.
My joy.
I'm Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.
It's supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious. Supercalifragilisticexpialidocious.
Because I was afraid to speak when I was just a lad. My father gave me nails a tweak, told me I was bad. But then one day I learned a word to save me aching nose.
The biggest word you ever heard, and this is how it goes. Oh, supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. Even though the sound of it is something quite atrocious, if you say it loud enough, you'll always sound precocious.
scrumptious, supergalifragilistic, it's the allodontious.
We travel.